Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives.
True, not everyone listens to Radio Netherlands.
I came to Casablanca for the waters.
The waters? What waters? We're in the desert.
I was misinformed.
Don't you wish you were better informed? Radio Netherlands, international public radio, direct from Europe.
Hello, glad you could join us for Towards 2000 Plus. I'm Diana Janssen.
And I'm Jonathan Marks. This is a compilation with a difference. Between the 11th and 14th of September 1995, Radio Netherlands, Holland's external broadcasting service, hosted a conference at the Rye Exhibition Centre on the south side of Amsterdam. Just over 200 people from over 40 countries came to hear a series of presentations, all connected with getting messages across borders.
We designed the lectures to start with policy and programmes on the first and second days, gradually introducing more technical topics for the third and final day. We expected people to pick what interested them and wander in and out. In fact, over 130 people attended all the sessions.
And sales of the complete tape transcripts were such that we decided this compact disc should be different, not just more of the same. It should add something to ongoing discussions. Towards 2000 was designed to present an overview of the current state of international broadcasting. We looked at the latest technological trends, such as Inmarsat's plans to provide programmes to moving aircraft, or live radio via the internet. This production takes some of the speeches at Towards 2000 and adds a follow-up. Promises were made back in September. We'll ask how far they've got in 1996 and what chances they have when the calendar shows the year 2000. Coming up, more on the clockwork wireless, digital shortwave and DAB.
But we also looked at the state of traditional technology, including the importance of direct shortwave broadcasts to developing countries. We heard presentations from delegates living in Africa, Asia and Latin America who point out how shortwave radio is still a lifeline. Victor Gunatilake, a teacher and broadcaster from Sri Lanka, maintains that broadcasters should still keep traditional systems running.
Well, yes, in North America, it was all internet and satellite broadcasting and more or less the same, I could say, for Europe. But in our parts of the world, although we would love one day to have satellite broadcasting directly into our homes and television, it's still a long way off from that because our listeners cannot afford the type of equipment needed for a direct satellite receiving or DAB and all the modern technology. And of course, internet, it's quite a bit of a problem when computers are so expensive, the hardware, software and all those things combined.
Mind you, just playing with the computer before we went in the studio, we did manage to find that there's a worldwide website in Sri Lanka. So it's not true to say that there's no internet at all.
Well, yes, there are a few internet users in Sri Lanka. We are happy that we have the technology and the facilities coming into Sri Lanka. But when you consider the investment on a computer and total hardware and the software, it's almost 100,000 rupees to get started. And that's the kind of money that very few people can afford. Certainly, some business organizations are on the internet already, but it'll be quite a long time before average shortwave listeners and hobby-interested people could get on the internet.
You said 100,000 rupees. How much is that in dollars?
Well, that's $2,000. And if you keep in mind that the majority of third world listeners would be on a $100 or maybe $150 monthly budget for everything, not just to spend on their hobby, that's a very big amount of money.
Lodewijk Bouwens, Director General of Radio Netherlands, opened the conference with a presentation entitled Radio Bites Back, in which he said it was time international radio stood up for itself.
We can also expect to be bitten in some areas by increased competition from television and video. People will only watch if new programs add to the choice already there. Fortunately, the price of television production is tumbling as concepts such as desktop TV become possible. Our experiments at the Radio Netherlands Training Center are in early stage, but the idea of montaging a program on a high-end computer was impossible just 3 years ago. Equipment then costing $3 million was needed. Now it's more like 30,000. But above all, I'm convinced that the most important threat to this industry comes from time, or rather, lack of it. In this part of Europe, at least, deadlines seem to be shorter for everyone. The listener or viewer has a lot of other things to do. The world economy is patchy. Those who have jobs have to work a lot harder than before and a lot longer just to make ends meet. In that respect, I think radio has an advantage. You can listen while on the move. Quality radio programs can be made at far less cost than television. And we know from the 125,000 letters we get each year and the nearly 10,000 hits a week on our internet pages that the radio can and does stimulate the listener to think and to react.
Media Network. We listen to you because you listen to us. Money quickly became a talking point towards 2000, with some delegates questioning whether it's desirable for public broadcasters to work together with commercial operations, especially when it comes to television. Sam Younger is the managing director of BBC World Service.
It's something that I think audiences become increasingly suspicious of the more you're involved with different commercial partners with their own motivations. I think the most particular problem that we have there in the BBC at the moment is in the Arabic channel we run, which is in cooperation with a company that is controlled by Saudi Arabian interests, and the suspicion from audiences that somehow there must be some degree of influence from the partner on what is being said editorially, even though I have to say for the moment, and I think the BBC has got the strength to resist this, I think any pressures would be roundly rejected. It is therefore uncomfortable to have this marriage of a commercially funded television internationally and publicly funded radio, but it's a challenge the BBC's taken up with alacrity, and it's been firmly endorsed by the British government. But there is another risk, if risk one can call it, and that paradoxically for radio is the risk of the success of television internationally. Up to now, the BBC's international television activities have been remarkably successful, I think, given the amount of time, the short amount of time, that the BBC has been in the market in international television. But there is a risk to radio, and that risk is that government, which still funds more or less 100% of our international radio activities, says television is the dominant medium, the BBC is becoming increasingly successful in international television, and of course international television isn't creating a drain on public funds. So if television is being so successful, do we need to fund radio anymore? I think that's not yet, in the British context, a very major issue, but I can't help feeling that the more successful the BBC is in international television, the more that question is going to be raised. And it's a question to which those of us operating in radio need a convincing answer. I think there is a convincing answer. Firstly, I think we do certainly need to reject the notion that television and radio are media in competition with each other. I think they should be much more seen as complementary. I found it striking, for instance, that in the development of the BBC's international television channel in India, where it's, I think, reached its greatest number of viewers, that the audiences are overwhelmingly new audiences to the BBC, that there isn't a drain from the BBC's radio services in the subcontinent to the television services. And in international broadcasting, up to now, there is a universality of radio signal. Increasingly, television services are becoming encrypted. International radio is universally available. Of course, that universal availability through shortwave is, we hope, over the years going to turn into universal availability through satellite to mobile receivers. There's a long transition period when shortwave is going to remain, I think, extremely important. And that's not a transition period of only a few years. I would put it certainly at a minimum of 20 years.
But that leaves the question, why has the BBC World Service regionalised its radio operation? Is it working?
I think like any sensible manager of a major public organisation, you don't answer a question that directly. I'd like to think it's working. It's too early, in a sense, in audience terms, to know whether it is working. And indeed, I suspect we will never know, because audiences aren't going to tell us that they've either started listening to World Service or continued listening to World Service because it reorganised itself into regions. But my sense is that we are in a position to tailor our services much better to audiences now than we were under our old organisation. I think the most important thing about the reorganisation for us is the strategic clarity it gives us. And that's extraordinarily important to us as we approach government for continued healthy funding for our international broadcasting effort.
The last quarter of 1995 saw budget cuts being proposed at the BBC, Voice of America, Radio Australia, and most severely at Radio Canada International. However, some of the technological costs are dropping as analogue circuits go digital. The World Factbook for 1995, published by the CIA, the US Secret Service, apparently has decided that no country uses shortwave anymore. All the country entries have a zero next to the number of HF transmitters. They clearly haven't listened to the radio recently.
Although the first signs of sunspot cycle 22 have been seen, we're still at a low point in sunspot activity. That means higher frequencies don't work very well, and so broadcasters are forced to use the overcrowded parts of the dial in the 31, 41 and 49 metre bands. International frequency coordination is much better than during the height of the Cold War, but tune the dial in Europe at night and there are still too few clean channels. So if you're making the best programmes in the world, what are the options? Towards 2000, companies such as Inmarsat, WorldSpace and the World Radio Network offered a satellite distribution as an alternative.
If you've got input on our output, there's a number to call round the clock from around the world. Dial your international exchange code, then 31 for Holland, 35 for Hilversum, then 6724222. Call and talk. The world is listening.
Wouldn't it be nice if you could jump in the car in Amsterdam, tune into your favorite station and listen to the same program while driving across Belgium, France and into southern Spain? Well, if the proponents of satellite-delivered digital audio broadcasting have their way, then we could have such a service in Europe by the year 2000. Hans Bockhuizen is technical policy advisor to the Radio Netherlands management team and was a speaker at the conference. Is there any urgent need to push for satellite DAB?
Yes, by judging the preliminary results of the study Radio Netherlands is undertaking for the European Space Agency, the answer is yes, because we've had an overwhelming interest shown in the ESA Archimedes project for satellite radio to Europe. To this end, about 100 questionnaires were sent to a whole variety of broadcasters in Europe, ranging from regional commercial broadcasters all the way up to the major international broadcasters like the BBC and Deutsche Welle. And 30 responded by filling in the questionnaire, and amongst these 30 were 17 international broadcasters. This in itself shows the tremendous interest by international broadcasters in satellite radio. And we've had some preliminary conclusions so far. One is that, and this came really as a surprise, that the majority of the broadcasters are not going for CD quality radio, but for the digital equivalent of FM stereo. For an international broadcaster using shortwave, apparently CD is one bridge too far maybe, and these organizations can very well live with FM stereo quality. Another interesting aspect was that there is interest shown in ancillary data services, but they don't necessarily have to be interactive, state of the art. The majority of the broadcasters are showing interest in a kind of enhanced form of RDS-like systems, as we now have on many FM stations. And they think in terms of offering program-related data, weather information, traffic data, things like that. Simple, non-interactive applications.
Do international broadcasters also want to reach mobile receivers. Is that their main objective?
Yeah, that's part of the system offered by ESA, and this certainly is of interest also to international broadcasters. Another surprise which came out of the study is that there is also a tremendous interest shown in stationary reception systems like Astra, ADR, Astra Digital Radio, are of importance to international broadcasters.
What's so unique about the Archimedes project if you compare it to the Astra Digital Radio?
The fact that it offers both mobile, stationary and portable reception. And of course, using Astra for radio, you still need that dish pointing towards the satellite. And using Archimedes in the future, just a small dish antenna the size of a CD will do. And there is no need to point it towards the satellite.
Hans, can we conclude that unless international broadcasters quickly claim the spectrum space around 1.5 gigahertz, it will be used for national and commercial services instead?
Yes, this is an aspect we didn't treat so far, but you're right. There is also the intention to start using this 1.5 gigahertz band, meant for satellite radio, also for terrestrial radio, specifically in Europe.
It's rather amusing to see all the press releases being launched at the moment connected with digital audio broadcasting. And just like Popov and Marconi 100 years ago, no one is really sure who's first to start DAB services. I think you could argue that until receivers are in the marketplace that you and I can buy at a reasonable price, any on-air services running now are simply experiments. The Dutch Nozema, the Netherlands broadcast transmitting company, is running a DAB service already and doing several tests with data casting, the transmission of text rather like worldwide web pages over the airwaves. With all this activity on the ground, how hopeful are we that satellite DAB will not be overshadowed? Gordon Harold of Brendan Associates has also been part of the ESA study.
I think it will happen. It's going to be a watershed in broadcasting for the future. And I think that satellite DAB is in fact going to ride on the back of terrestrial DAB, which of course is hitting the headlines at the moment with launches in the UK, Sweden and Germany.
But it's almost essential for the international broadcasters because terrestrial DAB at the moment doesn't get much further than the horizon.
Oh, you're absolutely right. But my reference to terrestrial DAB, of course, is that it's the same basic technology. It's merely translated into delivery via satellite. And I think compatibility, consistency, same technology, all of this is terribly important.
The European Space Agency knows that in higher latitudes, it will be much harder to get strong signals into build-up areas if you beam signals down from satellites in a geostationary orbit, namely positioned above the equator.
So the ESA Archimedes project is proposing to build satellites that orbit the Earth in a highly elliptical orbit. And this reduces the required transmitter power. In fact, the distance between satellite and receiver is much shorter this way. The project's being developed in Europe, but such a system would be able to provide satellite-delivered radio to Europe, the Far East and Canada. Kevin Galligan of the European Space Agency's Technology Centre in Noordwijk on the Dutch North Sea coast is also optimistic that you can drive across the continent in the future taking the same station with you.
Well, that's going to happen. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen probably towards the end of the decade, 99, in the year 2000. That's a realistic date in which we can expect to have satellites for this, and this would enable you indeed to go from Hilversum to the south of France or to the west of Ireland and listen to the same radio program in your car. Terrestrial broadcasting is probably going to follow a somewhat national career path, if that's the right word. Satellite is going to have a more international flavour. It's going to have world service broadcasters present, not just the British, but all the world service broadcasters. But it's also going to have pan-national broadcasters, people who are traditionally in pan-national broadcasting, such as Europe 1, CLT, and people like them. And we also believe there will be new services developed which are take advantage of the satellite functionality, which is inherently greater than national.
And in terms of delivery, I mean, it means to say that you're going to have two car radios, or will everything be combined into one box?
A combined radio is perfectly feasible. And in fact, you know, certainly I think your listeners are not interested in having two car radios. They want one box which does everything, including receives medium wave, long wave, short wave, and FM, as well as the new digital radio. So one box for terrestrial, for satellite, and for the old sorts of radio as well.
For how much?
Well, that's a delicate matter, and depends on manufacturers, it depends on their entry price philosophy, it depends whether they want to get rich quick or whether they want to stay in it for the long term. But we are convinced that a radio can be made and sold for around 300 EQs, and I'm not sure how to convert that into florins.
Well, it works out at around 600 guilders, or $350.
Geostationary satellites have severe disadvantages because they're down towards the horizon. We're proposing a concept or a satellite constellation which will overcome this and will in fact put the satellites right above your head at a high elevation angle, different from the geostationary approach, a little bit more radical, but certainly highly advantageous in terms of satellite power, and satellite power is what you pay for, essentially, its cost. So much lower cost. And in fact, for Middle Europe, which is perhaps centred around Hilversum, the geostationary approach is not at all feasible.
But if you put them in a different orbit, you then need more than one satellite, don't you?
You need, in fact, for what we're talking about, six satellites. That means you have to build and launch six satellites. These six satellites, in fact, only are used for a short period. So you could argue, in fact, that the system is even more resilient than a geostationary satellite, where if you have one satellite and it fails, you've lost 24 hours of service. If you lose one satellite, although it's not the sort of thing that broadcasters like to contemplate, if you did lose one satellite, you lose 4 hours of service out of the 24.
But how certain can we be that the proposals will ever be realised?
We'll have the answer to that question in about 10 months from now, because from now on, DASA, Daimler-Benz, will develop the business plan together with 9 or 10 other companies. If they manage to come up with a viable business plan, from there on, the financing of the project will start. ESA itself will take care of about 40% of the financing needed for the first three satellites. And if the beginning is okay with the business plan, then the ball starts rolling and we'll have the launch of the first three satellites towards the end of 1998.
And receivers are already on the market?
And the whole project is riding on Eureka 147 digital audio broadcasting, which was or is aiming at offering terrestrial digital audio broadcasting, but in principle the same receivers can be used, so the receivers are there.
Other people are trying to get direct satellite broadcasting going in different parts of the world. The charismatic Noah Samara is president of WorldSpace, based in Washington. He says the design of their receivers is finished and hopes to attract both domestic and international broadcasters as partners.
WorldSpace was founded in 1990 to implement a digital audio broadcasting service for the developing world. So our main target is the emerging markets of the world. Service is targeted to the 4 billion people living in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, Asia, the Caribbean, and so forth. It will come online, the service will, in the 1998 and 1999 time frames, because we'll be launching three satellites about 6 months interval starting in 1998. Broadcasters under the WorldSpace multi-carrier per-channel system will be able to uplink directly from their studio to the satellite. In our coverage area in particular, receiver costs must start at a much lower threshold than what we believe is tolerable in OECD countries. This is an obvious fact, but certainly a necessary fact to the success of our business. Finally, programming needs to follow the digital audio broadcasting receivers if any of these receivers are to sell. One guilder is too much money for a receiver that has none or bad programming. We are developing a radio which will have a basic cost, hopefully, of about $50. That is a manufacturer's cost. We may even consider subsidizing part of this cost to ensure that the usual 3 or 4 times the cost of, from manufacture to retail isn't prohibitive to some of the people within our coverage area.
Meanwhile, back on Earth, some European countries are discovering that there may be a bigger problem than the current lack of receivers. Ruud Vader, managing director of Nozema in Holland, says there is a second complication.
And that is that in the Netherlands, the number of broadcasters that want to be on DAB networks is exceedingly larger than the capacity of those networks as we plan them. And so we have to find ways of putting more broadcasters on those networks.
Nozema, which runs many of Holland's transmitter sites, has started a large-scale trial to see whether people can really hear the difference between CD-quality music and music which has been compressed and compromised, so as to take up less bandwidth in a DAB channel.
Let's have an instant demonstration using a piece of music by Johann Strauss the Younger. First of all, in CD quality. The roses from the south sound similar when digitized at 192 kilobits per second. Can you hear the difference when the rate is reduced to 112 kilobits per second? But what about when we halve the sampling rate once again, this time to 64 kilobits per second? The Nozema has compiled a special test compact disc which goes into more details, including some tests where they don't reveal the exact bitrate.
Nozema believes that the scarcity of frequencies may mean that broadcasters will have to use lower bitrates than originally planned, so as to squeeze more stations in the digital airspace allocated for DAB. Initial trials at Radio Netherlands Towards 2000 conference showed that people couldn't hear the difference until around 64 kilobits on speech, 96 kilobits in stereo. But things sound much worse on headphones. However, DAB will mean more than just sound broadcasting. If you can send digits, you can send data.
You can use data casting basically for two types of transportation. You have burst loading, very large volumes of bits, information bits, to be downloaded. Examples of that would be updates of legal documents, people who have a subscription on court proceeding outcomes, the same day or the day after they get their updates, rather than having to take that out of an envelope, take out the old pages, put in the new pages, updates of garage handbooks, whatever, large volumes. Okay, this is one other example. Thank you for calling me. This is an example of a data casting product that uses FM by Seiko. Seiko has created an FM scanner which is built into this watch, and it receives messages, not only messages like call office, call home, come home, also telephone numbers that you have to call, like paging, but also weather information. You get the expectations for the weekend. So there you are, gentlemen.
Towards 2000 with Media Network here on Radio Netherlands.
Perhaps one of the most fascinating debates that started in Amsterdam in September and is still going on in the internet discussion groups relates to receiver technology. Receiver manufacturers were quick to point out that there is a huge existing base of shortwave receivers in the world, as high as 600 million by some estimates, and that some international broadcasters are too quick to dismiss shortwave as out of date.
Whilst it's true that the mass media impact of shortwave is limited to a few parts of the world, such as Burma, with a world population now 5,733 million people and rising at around 1.5% a year, even audiences of a few percent add up to very significant numbers. Moreover, international audiences, especially on shortwave, are motivated as well as loyal. So why aren't there more shortwave listeners? Esmel Huzur is president of Grundig North America, based in Redwood City, California, and believes shortwave broadcasters should exploit the infrastructure they already have in place. The reason it hasn't taken off in a big way so far is because of a lack of dialogue.
By that I mean the broadcaster and manufacturers are not talking to each other. Manufacturers likewise have ignored consumers, and again, consequently, you have a structure which do well with some repairs. Consumers want to listen to international radio, and in many cases, the only international connection that can be afforded is through a shortwave radio. Shortwave, DAB, satellite TV, etc. are not mutually exclusive of one another. I remember when I had a few shares of some of the department stores, when Home Shopping Network first came out, I immediately sold them. I thought that's the end of department store, because everything is going to be bought through the television. But you can see Home Shopping Network has gone through three hands, and now the department store's growth is going on. And on that note, I like to say the real power, again, is not in the corridors of corporate America, of Senate or Parliament. It is in this room, among you international broadcasters. Thank you.
Richard McLaughlin is managing director of Low Electronics, a British company which has carved a profitable niche for itself by building radios for the specialist shortwave listener market. Richard explained that it all began in the late 1980s when they saw a market for a simple-to-operate tabletop set.
The Japanese approach to radios, receiving radios certainly, was to pile ever more and more gimmicks in terms of multiple memories and flashing lights and alarm clocks and all sorts of things. And we felt that there was a market for a product where the money would be spent primarily on the technical design and the performance of the product rather than all the flashing lights and gizmos. We started a small factory. We are still only a pretty small company. There's only 25 people in total in the company. We have now found ourselves in 1995 in a rather different situation, whereas say 5 years ago nearly everything we sold was imported from the Far East. Now something like 20 or 30% of what we sell is imported from the Far East, and our own manufactured product probably forms about just under a third to a half of our total output. We're in a price bracket rather at a different point to Grundig. We have about three models, and they sell to the end user at prices between sort of $600 and $1,200. We often wonder what proportion of our listeners buy radios to listen to the program, and what proportion actually buy it for the sake of finding the program and then, having found it and written it down, go on to the next one. And we do sell quite large volumes of the books that Esmail mentioned, WRTH, PWBR, and things like that, which are aimed almost entirely at the broadcast listener. So I would suspect that a goodly proportion of our listeners do actually buy a radio to listen to it rather than play with it. And a lot of our customers nowadays demand the more complex things, such as decoding software packages. All of our receivers now have the ability to do external computer control. That is almost a requirement in our end of the market. Geographically, probably because we're primarily a UK-based company, about 20% of our output is still sold into the UK. We have a very strong market in Western Europe, primarily in Benelux and Germany. Something like 60% of our output goes there. Why? I don't really know, but it does. Our market grew very fast in 1992, 1993. It has tailed off, the growth rate has tailed off in the last year, probably because our principal product has been sort of gone through its major part of its life cycle curve. We've just introduced a new product. Like Ismail, things like the Gulf War make a very, very big difference, we find, to our market. In the UK, you could not buy a shortwave radio during the period of the Gulf War.
Media Network's Asian media correspondent Victor Gunatilaka emphasised the growing technology gulf between developing and developed parts of the world, and he had some startling statistics.
In Sri Lanka and India, the figures are one television set per 28 people. In Nepal, 500 people, one television set. Can you imagine how many computers there would be? Most of the world, they live on less than $100 a month. Would it be reasonable to expect that as the year 2005 comes around, that the use of internet will come down so much that for $2 I will be able to use internet? Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, I think, 100 years ago. But still, in India, one telephone for 88 people. Just before I left, my telephone was out of order. Even last night, I couldn't get through to my home. That's the situation in the third world. So sometimes when we hear the words, shortwave is dead, we wonder whether we have all died in the third world.
In many technological programs broadcast in the last 2 months, there's been quite a lot of hype connected with the development of a clockwork radio. The British inventor Trevor Bayliss came to the Towards 2000 conference to explain why he tackled the problem of building a cheap-to-run radio for African listeners. He was sitting at home watching a television program about the spread of AIDS in Africa.
Now, the person then went on to say that the problem was that of education. How were they going to possibly educate the mass of people? Victor will tell you that you can't get the newspaper in the village. People, most of the people in the villages, in fact, are illiterate. Getting the information out was best solved by the use of the radio. Radio was by far the easiest means of communicating with people. You could give them this valuable sex education by the use of this means. Now, I'm a very, very rich kid, really. Well, kid, 58, death is my next big event. Anyway, I live on a delightful island in the middle of the River Thames. I've got a swimming pool in my back lounge. I've got a delightful studio where I play out my fantasies.
It was there, in the workshop, that Trevor decided to work on a problem that faces many listeners in the developing world, namely the exorbitant cost of batteries. He decided to look for an alternative, power generated from a spring.
What I did was to take a conventional spring, known to most people as a logarithmic spring. It's one of those springs you associate with the old clockwork toys. You wind the thing up and it gets progressively harder, as you know. And I found that, in fact, there was only a limited capacity I could get onto that spring. So the next thing I did then was to start looking at a system of producing power in a different type of spring. I started using a spring called a constant force spring. The best way to describe to you a constant force spring is one of those tape measures that you pull out. You know, you pull the tape out and it flies back into the hole. Now, if you were to take that tape out and now roll it in an opposite direction around another drum, if you release that tape, then the other drum would rotate. This is the principle of the constant force spring. The constant force spring delivers the same force when it's stretched to its fullest as when it's to its least.
He tried several combinations of gears connected to a tiny electric generator.
So what I did then was to take or to obtain a constant force spring, which I put into this box. This is the first of my clockwork radios. Very primitive. You see, it's made from bits of old plastic. And then once I got this combination together, I was able then very simply with a Zener diode to join my little electric motor to my transistor radio, limiting the power through the Zener diode that was needed to my radio. So that then was my first radio. Now, I don't know whether it's going to work in here. This place acts like a Faraday cage. If we... Hang on, have we got a bit of noise in? There we are, I'm getting sound. It's not me. So there was my first clockwork radio. What is actually happening is the spring is unwinding and then sound is coming out of my radio. Okay? Now, this thing will have to run down now. Now, that wasn't a very efficient machine. I was getting something like a 2-minute wind would give me 14 minutes of sound. But it was a beginning.
Trevor Bayliss publicized his invention in the hope that receiver manufacturers would build radios around his clockwork generator. He was very disappointed that initially there was not only no interest, but a hostile reaction from the scientific community. He recalls getting one letter from a Mr. Ormston Chant.
Anyway, Mr. Ormston Chant then trotted out. He said, I understand spring technology very well. My father was a master clockmaker. And then he went on, and he proved to me scientifically on this letter, right, that I couldn't make my radio work unless the spring weighed 100 weight. Now, I was totally confused now, you see, because...
The alternative, it was ironically suggested, was to use a thermocouple.
A thermocouple, right, is a thing. When you apply heat to it, it generates in a measure of electricity. Now, Mr. Ormston Chant carefully considered this one, and he thought, if I stuck a thermocouple up my backside, maybe I could run a transistor radio. Now, can you believe it? I suppose you could conceal the wires, couldn't you? So, we have a new element that's added to this whole equation. It's called humiliation. The next thing that happened was that the Overseas Development Administration got on board. They gave me 143,000 quid to make it happen. So, bully to the government, right? They made it happen. They turned this old crate here into this thing here, right? The next thing that happened is out of Africa, out of a radio broadcast, I managed to get Liberty Life of South Africa on board to give me 750,000 quid. Now, they then were able to get together a factory for me in which to make my products. Now, this is the most exciting thing of all. And this is because I was a creator of about 200 products for the disabled. This fellow from Liberty Life was able to put together a factory employing 150 disabled people making my clockwork radio.
Full-scale production of the radio started in October. By January 1996, the new edition of the World Radio TV Handbook announced Trevor Bayliss had been given the only award for 95 to 96, for the most innovative radio design. In fact, the design has already been changed.
The first radios that we had available came straight, there was a terrific pressure upon us to get the things out. And in fact, the initial ones had a gearbox, which was completely made up from gears. And we found that we were having rather a background noise, an unacceptable background noise from the final gear ratio. So we had to do something very quickly about it, and when we started to examine it and examine the noise and so on, we had to do certain modifications inside to improve it. And in fact, we've made the radio now so that it doesn't actually produce any noise at all. So that's the first marked improvement, and that is from those very early grey ones. Because it's got my name on it, clearly I don't want it to bring my parents' name into disrepute. So one of the first things we had to do is to eliminate this background noise. Now, that's been done. But since then, I've been able to do one or two things over here too. I've been able to put a new device, which we call a spring saver, inside the machine. What it enables you to do now is when you wind the machine up, if you turn the volume down, the machine will last longer. So that I've had running times up to an hour and a half to 2 hours on a very low volume setting using this new device. And that's going to be announced and it's going to be introduced to the radios as soon as we can. We have to obviously tool up for a new improvement, and that's a costly business. But we've had quite a sizable injection of money put into our Cape Town operation. The other thing is, with that injection of capital, we shall be able to get underway shortly in South America. That's the next place, I think, where we shall take off. So things are going very, very quickly.
And how many radios are being produced at the Cape Town factory at this time?
Well, at the moment, they're only producing about 500 or 600 a day. But we've got to get our production levels up from about 20-odd thousand to, well, as quickly as we can, up to 1 million a year in that operation. And we've got to do the same in South America. But this is only a touch, only a tip of the iceberg, because there are 600 million people that live in Africa alone. So I think that what we've got to try and do is to get one of the very large players to work with us as soon as possible. Thomson's of France, who are a very, very sizable and a very respectable organisation, have been talking to us recently. So if we can do something with them, it would be, you know, wonderful. I think the most important thing is that whatever we do, whichever company we go along with, which I think we'll have to do to at some stage, is that they've got to share our ethic, as it were. This product that we've got is not just about the acquisition of wealth, it's about quality of life, and it's all about those that manufacture as well as those that receive.
Now, it seems that Brazil will be the first place for production in Latin America. Other plans you have for 1996?
Well, there's no doubt about it. We found out over here that the First World want it as well. I mean, we had over here in London, or as you were, over here in the Shetland Islands, there was a terrible power failure problem where everybody had lost their power. And so there's a need, definitely, in the First World for this particular product. So they'll probably end up by having radios that are needed for the Third World in the style and shape and power that they call for. But there will be parallel development, I think, if we have a big player with us, to provide in the First World those items that they call for, which, generally speaking, they will probably be looking for smaller and neater rather than bigger and louder. Now, what I'll do then to conclude, to let the other guys get a look in, is I'll put this thing on and hope that we can get some sound back to the Faraday cage. If I put this over here, now we just hope. All right, should we chance? Now, you see, there's the wind-up mechanism on the side here. It's a simple key. And there's a little switch. Which one is it? No, that's the... Now, that radio there, for a 20-second wind, gives you 40 minutes of playing time. We're doing things that will run for an hour and a half, but you must expect to wind it for at least 35 seconds. There we are. Now, the extraordinary thing is that when we went to Africa, we thought everybody would want a small radio, you know, small, neat and powerful and so on. But in fact, no, that's what they... Quite the contrary. They wanted big and loud.
It was clear by playing with the sample at the Towards 2000 conference that Trevor Bayliss has got the generator principle all sorted out.
This is a mechanical device, and it, like your motor car, the spring will break and the gears will wear out. But we reckon we can get 6,000 hours out of it. But then you don't scrap your radio. You take this thing apart and you've got a cassette containing that engine, which you send back to us and we replace with like for like. Now, the nice thing about the old tech is that you can understand it. I would say the reason why the early 1950s motor car is so successful in India
is because when you open a bonnet, you can fix it. If it breaks, you can fix it. You buy a modern car, all you've got is a management system. It costs you 600 quid, and it won't start until the specialist comes in. With this, it's the same low-tech technology. If you can understand it, then you should be able to fix it. You've got to remember, this is the first machine, and we are limited because we only put £1 million into it, right? Now, that sounds a lot of money, but when you're developing and creating products and creating work and building factories, ain't a lot of beans.
So much for the Clockwork Wireless.
Radio Netherlands, another detour on the path to self-improvement.
If you tune in between the broadcast bands, you'll find all sorts of digital modes of transmissions, like telex traffic between ship and shore. But these systems don't work fast enough to be able to transmit speech and music across the ionosphere. However, vast improvements in error correction methods is prompting some researchers to think again. 10 years ago, the idea of a 28.8K telephone modem was unthinkable. Now, it's a consumer product. The growing pressures on the radio spectrum, so rather than abandon shortwave frequencies altogether and move entirely to satellite, scientists in France and Germany are trying to breathe new life into shortwave by using knowledge of the 90s. Ken Hunt is the head of broadcasting technology at the European Broadcasting Union and has been following the developments closely. We ask Ken whether he thinks shortwave broadcasting will ever go digital.
Shortwave, I'm sure, will be going digital. It's not something that will happen in the next year or two, but undoubtedly that's the way that most services are going. Broadcasting is no exception. To go digital means better quality, perhaps greater capacity, by far greater freedom from interference and the general defects that deter people from using shortwave broadcasting at the moment.
Shortwave's unique selling point is the ability to reach portable receivers thousands of kilometers away. The problem is that, compared to satellites, you need to use hundreds of kilowatts instead of hundreds of watts to achieve this goal. With the ending of the Cold War, some of the frequency duplicity that stations employ during the days of heavy jamming has been reduced. However, powers of 250 and 500 kilowatts are still common. The use of digital technology in shortwave broadcasting might provide a route to make far more efficient alternatives. Could powers be reduced?
Yes, it is difficult to say by how much. We have to allow some margin for the variations in the ionosphere and the problems that you have with shortwave transmission generally, but probably a reduction of 5 to 10 times in the power is going to be possible. It's not really fair to compare satellite broadcasting with shortwave broadcasting in terms of power. The two media are quite different.
But in some recent trials in both Geneva and the United States, shortwave signals were able to get further inside a building than signals coming from a satellite.
Yes, of course, it's also got more power. You trade one against the other. Satellites could get into buildings if you push enough power there. The difficulty is you don't have large power stations in space to power the satellites.
But is there any interest from receiver manufacturers in this early research? Such a system doesn't have much future if we don't end up with cheap, portable radios that are able to work using the digital system.
Well, we'll avoid the word cheap. Inexpensive is sometimes used, but my guess is that any manufacturer is going to be interested if he can see there's a possibility for a profit.
Engineers still have to find ways to compensate for errors caused by fading, but the problem is not as difficult as it was a decade ago. On the other hand, we're seeing radio programs being sent in a digital form via the internet. Is there a chance that internet pages might someday be broadcast to remote locations by shortwave? A digital system doesn't discriminate between text, audio or video. It's just that they need different amounts of bandwidth.
I think that in terms of audio transmissions on the internet, if we can put it like that, if that happens, it's a long way off. The problem is the actual capacity of the internet. From the point of view of using the internet for carrying information about broadcasts, for carrying information supplementary to broadcasts, effectively text and static pictures the internet's a fantastic medium. That is not the same thing as saying it's ideal for real-time or even offline radio. The capacity is just not there. If you have too many users, the internet will clog up.
But what's the definition of too many users?
That, to some extent, depends on the compression technology that might be developed and the sort of area that you're talking about. But it's measured at the moment, I think, in terms of hundreds rather than tens of thousands within a small area.
So Ken Hunt at the EBU still believes that traditional broadcasting will reach more people in the foreseeable future than any internet system of radio distribution.
Peter Zenger, chief engineer for Germany's external service, Deutsche Welle, explained that they're planning some trials in 1996 using the digital mode. But which system or systems will be tested and when?
Well, there are two ideas, actually, one from the Deutsche Telekom and one from the CCEIT in France. And both are very different. So the question would be which one will survive or if both have a chance. The Deutsche Telekom is very much pushing their system to be at least tested. And we got together in Paris, together with Tomcast and Telefunken, to discuss how to proceed. And the decision was France and Germany would apply for an Eureka project to get finance from Brussels to get the project started.
That's the transmission side. What about the receiver side? Any interest from the receivers?
Yeah, there's great interest from receiver side, but as the receiver manufacturers have problems with DAB implementation, they're a bit reluctant and they want to wait how this develops. Manufacturers from the Far East showed very great interest because they see a great chance that even their shortwave receivers of today, of the analog technique, will survive in a digital environment.
Well, what's the advantage of using terrestrial shortwave transmitters in a digital mode as opposed to, let's say, satellite broadcasting?
Well, first of all, the quality is much, much better than of the analog shortwave. Secondly, you have no more interference or fading. Of course, the question of graceful degradation has to be answered. Nobody knows it yet. The size of the target area has to be checked if it is smaller or bigger. What we can expect already now is that the transmitter power will be much lesser than in the analog world. They talk about the factor 10.
Now that's good news if you see the power bills of the average shortwave radio station. There's one final point to add here on the subject of digitizing radio that was launched at towards 2000.
In the next few months, Radio Netherlands, along with several other international broadcasters, will expand the experiments with digital audio via the worldwide computer network called the Internet. In London, the World Radio Network currently estimates around 800 people a day tune into their audio-on-demand service using real audio on the Internet. Jeff Cowan, Director of Development at World Radio Network, said in Amsterdam he saw a great future for real audio. Now that experiments have started, the quality is still only comparable to good shortwave.
Well, we've been using Real Audio now for a couple of months. That's the Real Audio Release 1 system, the system that runs at 10 kilobits a second. And it does sound a bit sort of burbly and underwaterish at times, particularly when the internet is very busy. And we notice here in Europe in the afternoon the internet is very, very busy and packets do arrive late and it causes funny noises when you're accessing Real Audio. We have not yet tried Real Audio 2. We know some other broadcasters are experimenting with it. Some people have been a bit disappointed with Real Audio 2 after expectations were raised by people, or many of the manufacturers, saying that it would be FM-like quality. But it isn't quite FM quality. And it also needs a very powerful PC. It really only runs well on a Pentium, which is a limitation for many people who have got 386s and 486s.
But come on, Jeff, there's competition now from other people as well.
There is, and it's really gaining in its strength. There are three competitors for Real Audio. Two are fairly similar, that is iWave and True Speech. They both work in fairly similar ways. You're able to hear the audio. As soon as the stream hits you, your player plays it. You don't have to wait for a complete file to arrive. There's another system called Zing, and Zing works very well for a stream of live audio, and we're presently putting out two streams of live audio using the Zing system, and that's proved to be very popular. The same sort of amount of data that Real Audio needs, about 10 kilobits a second, produces rather better quality with Zing, And it's an international standard. It's, again, the MPEG standard, which is used on satellites and a whole range of audio systems these days that Zing have adopted. I personally don't think that this is the end of the road at all. I think these systems will go on developing. There is a whole new type of system which is based on what's called Layer 3 technology, which is still yet to hit the general internet users. And as soon as that's available, I think we'll probably get even better quality than we're getting at the moment with Zing using the MPEG system.
But Jeff, isn't there a danger that all this internet technology will put a satellite network like World Radio Network out of business?
No, it seems to help us in a way, because we're able to augment satellite and cable and all the other kinds of distribution feeding to local stations around the world with internet. And it just adds something else. And we often find that the people who contact us via the internet are quite different from the people who are shortwave listeners. On the west coast of the US, we find that real audio is very popular. A lot of people have written to say that reception from Europe can be very, very poor. And they get very, very good service from the internet.
Radio Netherlands, where great minds drink alike. Sorry, think alike.
Well, of course, any successful conference has its social side, but as well as making friends, we also made deals to take the spirit of the conference much further. Radio Netherlands launched the idea of three electronic workshops to exchange ideas via the internet. One is about experiences connected with digital editing, for in July of 1995, it became cheaper to store sound on a hard disk than on conventional tape, although, of course, it's more difficult to take a hard disk into the studio. BBC World Service, Deutsche Welle, Radio Sweden, Radio Canada, Radio Australia, Channel Africa and Radio Netherlands are just some of the stations using digital editing technology to improve their radio production. This new forum allows a frank exchange of experiences.
The second forum has been set up to exchange ideas on legal affairs. In the good old days, stations broadcast from their own country and paid copyright fees to their respective national bodies that represent the performers. Now, with satellite rebroadcasting and placement, the whole broadcasting media has become a jungle. And where does internet fit into all of this? Some of it really questions the real definition of broadcasting. The new legal forum on the internet has been set up to help international broadcasters.
And last but not least, with more stations joining the internet every day with email and World Wide Web services, the International Broadcasters Internet Forum is designed to give internet producers and operators at stations around the world all the latest URLs as well as news from the net. If you're working in the industry and would like more information, simply send email to this address, media@rnw.nl, and we'll send you back full details.
In 1997, Radio Netherlands will celebrate 70 years of international broadcasting. You could say that 1927 marked the start of the information superhighway. Radio Netherlands will also be celebrating 50 years since its foundation with a special conference in May. We hope you'll make a day to join us then, and in the meantime, you can get communications news this coming Thursday in the weekly program Media Network.
Towards 2000 had a deliberate link with ships, receptions on boats, dinner at the National Maritime Museum, so the list went on. We thought of hiring Rod Stewart to play us out with his version of sailing, but a commercial satellite station bought the rights before us. However, we were able to secure an exclusive agreement with the duo The Galantis, who sang through a megaphone on board that cruise ship on Wednesday night, September 13th. If you missed it, then grab a dictionary to translate the words. If you were there, of course, it'll all make sense.
On behalf of sound engineer Frank Meijer, Jonathan Marks and myself, thanks for listening.
Goedenavond, lieve mensen, goedenavond. Fred en Jannie zijn weer terug uit Napoli. Ik heb met mijn buikie vol Roomse pasta. Hij verslaafd aan Italiaanse broccoli. Al die zalig macho mafioso types op hun Vespa snorrend langs de boulevard. Met die joekels in hun strakke leren broekjes
Oh, wat klopte toen mijn kleine hartje raar. Krijg de kleren, zegt hij, die spaghetti vreters. We gaan naar Holland, spruitjes eten bij je ma. Ik koop een Alfa en we gaan naar Appelscha. Goedenavond, lieve mensen, goedenavond. Fred en Jannie zijn weer terug uit Napoli. Ik hem met mijn buikie vol roze pasta. Hij verslaafd aan Italiaanse broccoli. Al die zalig macho mafioso types op hun Vespa snorrend langs de boulevard. Met die joekels in hun strakke leren broekies. Oh, wat klopte toen mijn kleine hartje raar. Krijgt de kleren, zegt hij, die spaghetti vreters. We gaan naar Holland, spruitjes eten bij je ma. Strakke leren broekies. Oh, wat klopte toen mijn kleine hartje raar. Krijgt de kleren, zegt hij, die spaghetti vreters. We gaan naar Holland, spruitjes eten bij je ma. Ik koop een Alfa en we gaan naar Appelscha. En dan zijn we Romeo en Julia.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. Some people get static. Some people get far off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
You can hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.